Live from the nation's capital, President Joe Biden and comedian Colin Jost headlined the White House Correspondents' Dinner. See all the biggest stars together in one room live April 27th at 8 p.m. on CNN and streaming on Max.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
For those that have counted California out, eat your heart out.
Governor Gavin Newsom fights for the state of California's health and for his own political life. He joins me from Sacramento. And
stories bring us together.
Grief, love, and nature. I talked to Turkish-British novelist Elif Shafak about her latest novel, The Island of the Missing Trees, and the power of storytelling. Then, a report from Iran, where this week revolutionary hardliner Ebrahim Raisi becomes president, threatening even worse relations with the West. Plus,
I would argue that racism can and does flourish in a culture of niceness.
White Fragility author Robin DiAngelo tells Michelle Martin why she called her new book Nice Racism and the backlash that comes with it.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. California is roaring back. That is the view of its governor, Gavin Newsom, even if his own fate is less certain. He's facing a rare recall election this September, and the governor is trying to rally support amid COVID spiking again in the state, contentious debates over mask mandates, raging wildfires, and a drought that's plaguing nearly half the state. A lot to talk about, and the governor is joining me now from the state capital, Sacramento. Welcome to the program, Governor Newsom. Can I ask you where you are in terms of COVID and the fact that California is one of, I think, 20 states that has just over half its population vaccinated? Why do you think you're suffering this spike again now in places?
Yeah, we have among the highest vaccination rates in the country. 76.2% of all eligible Californians have received at least one dose, 45.3 million doses administered. That's 17.8 million more than the next state, largest state, Texas. That said, your question is the right question. Why are we seeing an increase? We have a case rate that now has grown over the last 7 days to 17.5%. We're seeing an increase in hospitalizations, just shy of 5,000 people now hospitalized. That's nowhere near our peak of 22,000. But it's simply this, and it's well known and well described. It's a pandemic that now is disproportionately impacting the unvaccinated, and we still have a stubborn number of folks that are unvaccinated in the state, and that's where we're seeing the big increase.
So building on that, the statistics show that more than 90% of Californians live in areas where community spread is, quote, high or substantial. So you have sort of danced around, if I can say, the question of whether you'll order mandates of any kind, mask mandates or the rest. The Bay Area is calling for it. We see New York City is calling for certain mandates to go indoors now, whether it's restaurants and the like. Why do you not just come out, given this spike you're talking about, and given those who are vulnerable, and just declare certain mandates?
Well, we were the first state in the country to do just that last week. In fact, California led the way by mandating that every state employee be vaccinated or verify vaccination or submit to weekly testing. But we took it a step further. That included all healthcare workers, 2.2 million healthcare workers all totaled. We also worked with private sector. You saw some of the largest healthcare providers in the country just this week, Kaiser following suit, some of the largest employers in America and the world, Facebook, Google, and others following similarly. And of course, the president himself doing it with all federal employees. California led a year ago, the first stay-at-home order. We have mask mandates in place throughout the Bay Area in Los Angeles. We have mask guidelines and indeed mask mandates, one of the first states in the country to do it for all schools as they reopen as well. So we've been assertive, we've been aggressive, and we're really proud of where California stands. That being said, we're sober and mindful and humbled by the nature of the Delta variant in particular.
What about the controversial notion of vaccine mandates? You know, we've seen the federal government do some in certain areas. Would you consider doing that? And again, you know, you've held things like cash lotteries to boost uptake. You're requiring more than, you know, nearly 2.5 million state and healthcare workers to provide proof of vaccines. Given the fact that it does appear that the worst affected people are those who are unvaccinated, would you do that? And if not, how do you persuade not the hostile, but the hesitant, the vaccine hesitant?
Well, we've been working at a scale no other state has worked to address vaccine hesitancy. And as we suggested and we have asserted, we've been very aggressive in terms of requiring verification. We've digitized the cards. We've been very aggressive working with the private sector in terms of efforts. And we are open to doing what we must in order to stem the spread of this disease. That said, as it relates to the hesitancy, we made real progress in the last week. We've seen a significant increase in the number of people being vaccinated. In fact, over a three-week period, we've seen a significant increase. These vaccine lotteries and incentives may not be everybody's cup of tea, but they've worked here in the state of California. We've seen an increase in the most important quartile, which is a quartile that disproportionately underrepresented in terms of vaccines and health outcomes. And that's in our minority communities, particularly Latino and African-American community, where we're starting to see an uptick, which is very encouraging. Look, 76.2% is not where we want to be, but it's substantially better than most states. We'll continue to accelerate our efforts. And we're working with barbershops and faith-based communities, mobile sites, no longer fixed sites. We're knocking on doors, 1.6 million doors. We've knocked on 1.3 million phone conversations. We've had referrals, incentives across the spectrum, doing what we can to increase these rates.
Can I just ask you then about Republican governors? You know, clearly there has been a pretty clear division between certain parts of the United States. We can see it all the way from here in the UK, where many politicians have, up until now, been sort of rubbishing the idea of vaccines and talking about freedom and this and that. In the last couple of days and weeks, Republicans and conservatives have been getting on board with the vaccine bandwagon. And indeed, we have a soundbite from Alabama's Kay Ivey. Let's just listen to what she said.
But it's time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks, not the regular folks. It's the unvaccinated folks that are letting us down. I've done all I know how to do. I can encourage you to do something, but I can't make you take care of yourself.
So, you know, that is the Republican governor of Alabama. There have been a lot of problems with the spread in the South, of course. What do you say now to them and what they might have been able to do had they been saying that kind of stuff from the beginning?
Yeah, look, I'm not here to judge the performance in other states. Each state is completely unique and distinctive. And I'll remind folks, internationally, California is not only the largest state in America, that's the fifth largest economy in the world. The population in California is the size of 21 states in America combined. And so the nuances, the regional differences are challenging. That said, let's just be honest. The misinformation coming from the Republican Party from the get-go has impacted our vaccination rates here in this country. That misinformation is being profited by well-known pundits on particular networks that have simply misled or lied intentionally to people about the efficacy and safety of these vaccines. We need to call them out. We need to call out that misinformation. It's nice to see, as you suggest, this bandwagon in the last few weeks when these guys recognized that their political futures may be at stake to now jump on board. But you're absolutely right. Where the hell have they been in the last 5-6 months? People are literally dying because of that misinformation and these pundits that are out there profiting themselves by spreading that information. And let's be candid. Look, it's primarily coming from the Republican Party in the United States and those that back the party and amplify their voices of their leaders. And there are a few exceptions. Mitch McConnell, thank you for your leadership, but a few exceptions. And increasingly, we're seeing some more bold moves. But again, it's coming a little too late, but I'm encouraged nonetheless, despite the fact that it's not as timely as we had hoped.
You know, I'm struck by what you said about political futures and them, you know, concerned about their political futures. Obviously, you are as well fighting for your own. I'm going to get to that in a moment, plus more California-specific questions. But I do need to ask you, as a governor, as a Democratic governor of the most populous state in the United States, your Democratic governor colleague Cuomo has just been accused by the Attorney General after an investigation of sexually harassing multiple females in state government, former state government, and those outside state government. She's also suggested that he has violated state and federal law. He has denied it in a press conference, just as we've been speaking. Do you think he should resign? What do you think he should do? What is the right course of action now?
Well over a year ago, I was very clear, and many of my Democratic colleagues were clear in expressing our concern about the seriousness of these allegations, and also complimenting and celebrating the courage of the women that came forward and put their reputations on the line. All of that said, waiting for the outcome of the investigation. It's an interesting fact that not only is the governor responding as we speak, and I haven't been the beneficiary of that response, but nor was I a beneficiary of hearing the press conference from the AG. We were on the phone with the White House Governors, National Governors Association, was doing a conference call listening to Dr. Fauci about the spread of the Delta virus. And so I want to wait till I have the benefit of the knowledge that many have before I opine further. But these are serious allegations and deep respect and admiration for the women that came forward.
So I realize that you don't want to be specific, but as I say, the New York Attorney General's office has concluded this months-long investigation. And again, she has suggested that he's violated the law, both federal and state. In fact, she said it. She's interviewed, or her people, 179 witnesses, 74,000 pieces of so-called of evidence, and apparently 11 women have come forth. As you say, they're brave. You yourself in your own state have enacted measures that give women the chance to come forward and complain and allow them an unhostile environment in which to address these things. You know, so much has been made. And this is, by the way, beyond the Me Too time period. It's a time period alleged between 2013 and 2020, also in the midst of COVID response.
Yeah.
You know,
well, Christian, this is beyond
pretty
serious.
Much defies
zero tolerance for this behavior, zero tolerance for the behavior. I guess the burden is, as we speak, I don't have the beneficiary of that back and forth. But as I said, I've been consistent. These are serious allegations. Applaud the courage of the women. I'm not just saying that to be rote. I mean that quite sincerely. We have zero tolerance for that out here in the states. And these allegations, if proven true, and it sounds like the Attorney General was very assertive in proving them true, are outrageous, and the governor should be held to account.
All right. And of course, as I said, the governor has denied all those allegations. So let me now ask you, because it's pretty much an uncomfortable situation. You're battling COVID plus climate, plus the drought, plus, you know, homelessness and evictions and all the other things, and fighting for your own political life. There is a rare recall that's been lodged against you, and it's going to happen in September. What are your chances? What do you think you'll be able to pull out? Because the polls were pretty much, you know, in your favor for a while. Now they seem to be dropping a little bit. There may be some, you know, election fatigue amongst Democrats. What do you have to do to remain in office?
Well, we've got to do our job. And you're right. I mean, we have crises stacked on top of crises as it relates to climate change. If you don't believe in COVID science and the efficacy and safety of vaccines, and you don't believe in climate science, come out here on the West Coast and see for your own eyes the extreme weather that we're experiencing, these record-breaking heat domes, these record-breaking fire seasons. Last year, 4.2 million acres burned here in California. We're roughly double now the acres burned year to date this year compared to that record-breaking year last year. We've got challenges on the entire West Coast of the United States with an extreme, what is referred to as mega drought. And of course, we're still dealing residually with the challenges of racial, social, environmental, and economic justice. That said, I'm really proud of our state and its resiliency. $80 billion operating surplus, the highest GDP over the last 5 years of any Western democracy, outperforming Germany, Japan, the United States as a whole. The state is indeed coming back. But we have disparities, homelessness, cost of housing that we have to battle. All of those things need to be attended to. At the same time, you're right, we attended to feeding this Republican-backed recall, whose principal sponsor wants to microchip immigrants. This is the sixth recall effort in just 30 months I've been in office. It's backed by all the folks that were out there on January 6th. And of course, backed by many members of the Trump administration and the Republican Party itself, Newt Gingrich, Mike Huckabee, and the whole crew of them, Devin Nunes, behind this. It's a power grab. We're going to defeat it, and we're going to continue to do good work for the people in this state, regardless of their political stripes. But we got a lot of work to do between now and September 14th to do that.
And one of the principal sponsors, in fact, the leading Republican running against you, is a talk show host, conservative Larry Elder. He told a local news station that he believes in climate change, but that he's not sure it's playing a role in California's worsening fires. He's blaming mismanagement from you, from your office, saying you haven't taken care enough of, you know, of the forest land and all the rest of it. And also they're blaming you for so-called COVID mismanagement and imposing too many restrictions. Given the fires, given the spike in COVID, what would you answer to that?
Well, look, our health outcomes outperform the rest of the country in terms of COVID, including states that he tends to revere, Texas and Florida, Indiana. And not only did our health outcomes outperform, our economic condition, our GDP contracted at a more modest rate than those states in the U.S. as a whole. As it relates to forest management, we put record investment in vegetation management, forest management, fuel reduction, pre-positioning assets, more technology, and more progressive strategies to deal with these wildfires. It's important to note, you're seeing them all throughout the West Coast of the United States, not unique to California. With all due respect to the folks that are running in this recall, I'm not running against any of them. They're running against themselves. There's 46 of them. I mean, you can't make up their positions on the climate. They don't believe in climate science. That same individual you referenced wants to increase offshore oil drilling in California and set us back and spew more toxicity into our air and pollute the environment. And so that's what's on this ballot. This is a serious moment in California and, I would argue, American history. The values we hold dear in the state of California are on the ballot. Climate science is on the ballot. Our health policies, our immigration policies are on the ballot on the 14th. And that's why we have to stop this recall and get Democrats engaged in recognizing what's at stake, including our National Democratic Party, to recognize the imperative of keeping this state on track.
A lot at stake, indeed. Governor Newsom, thank you so much for joining us. And we're turning now to Iran, where President-elect Ebrahim Raisi is about to take office. Now, he was officially accepted by the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei ahead of Thursday's inauguration. He's a much more hardline, revolutionary, anti-Western politician than the outgoing president, Hassan Rouhani. Correspondent Fred Pleitgen takes a look at what's top of Raisi's to-do list and whether the Biden administration will actually be able to negotiate a desired return to the Iran nuclear deal with him.
Iran's political transition is nearly complete as the incoming hardline president Ibrahim Raisi is officially accepted by Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Raisi vowing to try and get sanctions on Iran lifted, but not cooperate with countries like the U.S. "We will definitely seek to eliminate and lift the tyrannical sanctions," he said. "We will not make the people's livelihood conditional. We will not tie all these things to foreigners. We will definitely pursue the matters that are immediate issues for us and we are facing today." Iran faces a multitude of immediate issues. The economy continues to struggle as tough sanctions put in place by the Trump administration continue to take their toll. Water shortages have recently led to demonstrations, some of them violent, in parts of the country, with Iran's supreme leader saying he understands the protesters and that their demands need to be addressed. Raisi vowing to tackle the matter. "These matters have been detected, and I assure the people that the solutions have been delineated, and we have benefited from the views of experts and scholars, and this will be urgently dealt with." Raisi will take office amid heightened tensions with the West. The U.S., Israel, and the U.K. are blaming Iran for the drone attack on the Israeli-linked tanker Mercer Street, an attack that killed two sailors from Britain and Romania.
"We are in very close contact and coordination with the United Kingdom, Israel, Romania, and other countries, and there will be a collective response."
Iran denies the allegations and is warning against any retaliation. The incoming administration in Tehran says it will get tougher on the U.S., while negotiations are continuing to try and revive the Iran nuclear agreement. Ibrahim Raisi has already shot down any direct talks with Washington. When asked at a recent press conference if he would speak with President Biden, he simply said no.
Not a good sign. That was correspondent Fred Pleichen, who's joining me now live from Tehran. Fred, for a while it seemed that this nuclear deal was going to, you know, restart. Now it seems that it's quite dicey, that it may not happen, and Iran is gathering up more enriched uranium since Trump's action of pulling out of this deal. What is the feeling there about this deal happening?
Yeah, I think, Christian, honestly, I think that the feeling is actually getting worse, that the Iran nuclear agreement could come back into full force, that the U.S. could rejoin the deal, and that the Iranians would come back into full compliance. One of the interesting things that I've heard on the ground here in Tehran, speaking to analysts who are very close to government officials, very close to the power center here, they said the thing that the Iranians really were hoping for is that when President Biden took office, is that he would bring the U.S. almost immediately back into the nuclear agreement, that he would do it almost similarly as the U.S. did, for instance, with the Paris Climate Agreement, and bring the U.S. back and then try to negotiate certain things that the U.S. doesn't like about the agreement, like, for instance, some of the sunset clauses that, of course, have moved on despite the fact that Iran now has more enriched uranium, and also the fact that the U.S., of course, wants other agreements at least to be talked about in the future, other things like, for instance, Iran's ballistic missile program, some of Iran's actions here in the Middle East specifically as well. The Iranians are now saying, or at least the folks that I've been speaking to here, with every day that passes, it becomes more difficult for the two sides to come to an agreement. What you've had so far is you've had the negotiators from the Rouhani administration and the negotiators from the Biden administration indirectly, essentially speaking to each other in Vienna. Now you have a fully new administration that's coming in here in Tehran, and the question is whether or not there's going to be more hitches. On the other side, you have the U.S. side that's saying, yeah, they believe that they want to come back to the nuclear agreement, but they also say that the talks can't go on forever. So while the last time that I was here, which was right when the election was happening in Iran, there was a lot of confidence that the deal was going to take place, that it was going to come back. Now, I would say there's a lot less confidence here in Tehran that the deal will happen. They still want it to happen, but certainly the window seems to be getting smaller, seems to be closing, Christian.
And Fred, I need to ask you about the mood on the street, so to speak. There's an unprecedented amount of stress amongst the people there, huge protests. They're not afraid to come out and demonstrate. Ibrahim Raisi is a really hardliner, a real revolutionary, a violator of human rights, according to the international community, and threatening to put the people in the country 40 years back into those dark revolutionary days. What are the people saying to you about what they fear will happen, you know, socially, not just when it comes to foreign policy?
Well, right now, when we go out and we talk to people here on the ground, the number one priority for them, the number one concern that people have is definitely very much the economy. Of course, there's a lot of social issues as well, but the economy right now is really on a lot of people's minds. The past 3 years, or the past 4 years, under the Trump administration, especially, of course, since those big sanctions came into effect, those crippling sanctions, the maximum pressure campaign, those have hurt a lot of people here in this country. And even large parts of the middle class have been extremely hurt by the fact that these sanctions were in place. You add to that to the fact that you have a massive COVID outbreak, one wave after the next, going through this country, making it very, very difficult for businesses to reopen, but of course also a big public health risk as well. And those are things that, of course, people say this new administration, they obviously know how conservative it is, definitely has to deal with. And I think that Ibrahim Raisi understands that he has a big task on his hand. It was quite interesting because obviously at that event today when he was accepted by the Supreme Leader, one of the first things he said is he understands that corruption needs to be fought here in this country, but he also understands that, yes, they need to work towards getting rid of the sanctions and at the same time also very much repairing this country's economy and then going from there. Right now, it certainly is a very, very difficult economic situation here in this country, and one that, as long as the sanctions are in place, it's going to be very hard to mend, Christian.
Fred, thanks. Thanks so much from that report from Tehran. Now, we turn to novelist Elif Shafak, who's out with a new book, The Island of Missing Trees. It's a tale of love and war spanning London to Cyprus. And Elif is joining me now from London. Welcome back to the program, Elif Shafak. And your new book is causing a lot of waves, a lot of good reception and good reviews, magical storytelling as usual. But I want to ask you to tell me about the trees and the nature and the natural world through which you tell this story. What made you focus on that?
I think there are two layers. I have been wanting to write about Cyprus for a long time now, but I couldn't dare because it's a difficult story. It's a very emotional story and the wounds are not healed yet. So I didn't know how to approach the story until I found the fig tree, the voice of the fig tree. And what brought me closer to the tree was, like many people throughout the pandemic and the lockdown, I also began to rethink about my own connection with nature, with trees, with earth. You know, those seemingly small moments, just sitting under a tree, reading a book. I felt the need to reconnect, and that gave me the idea, you know, into the story of the fig tree.
So I'm going to get back to the trees in a moment, but you've brought up Cyprus and where your story is set. So tell us, tell the viewers about Cyprus, because it's clearly still, I think it's the only divided capital in Europe, Nicosia, the capital of Cyprus, between Greek and Turkish Cypriots. Civil war of the 70s still has not been resolved. So just set the scene for us about Cyprus and your main characters.
Indeed, this is a divided island, and there are so many hurts and pains accumulated due to the division and the very complex history, clashing nationalisms. I think the story, I'm hoping, might also resonate with anyone who comes from troubled pasts and divided lands. Basically, this is a novel about intergenerational memory and trauma. I think I do believe in inherited pain. I know it doesn't sound very scientific, but I do believe that the stories and silences that run in our families somehow shape us. And I have met many immigrant families or families in exile or families coming from difficult pasts in which the first generation bears the memories. The second generation is busy adapting, finding their feet, belonging. But it's the third or the fourth generations, the youngest in the families, that are digging into the memories of their ancestors. They want to know more about their identity. So the story partly takes place in London with Ada, who is the child of a Greek Cypriot and a Turkish Cypriot. And there are so many things that she never heard about. At the same time, I think this is a book about renewal, nature, ecological thinking and eco-consciousness.
So let's talk about that aspect of inherited trauma and generational trauma that you do focus on. So Ada is the daughter in this novel. Her parents, Daphne and Kostas, are, it's almost Romeo and Juliet. They're from different sides of the Cypriot divide. And that causes a huge amount of drama and this forbidden love story, etc. Talk to us about that, and then I want to read you a little bit of what you've written about it.
They're very different personalities, Daphne and Kostas. I think they're both interested in healing. They want to heal their divided islands, and they understand the pain. But Kostas does that through connections with nature as a botanist. Daphne, on the other hand, is involved in the Committee on Missing Persons, which is so important under United Nations. Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots are working together in a way to unbury the bones of the dead, of the missing, not in order to revive old animosities, but to give the dead dignity, a proper burial, funeral, and the families a sense of closure. I think similar trajectories have been also experienced in countries like Guatemala, Chile, Argentina, Iraq, Bosnia after the genocide. So digging into this past is an important metaphor throughout the book. It is a love story. It is a forbidden love story in a way. But it's also the story of, you know, how do we carry our memories? Is it possible to have coexistence and renewal and love?
So let's get back to the fig tree and the title of your book, you know, Missing Trees, because I want to know how it reflects on this war and this love story, but particularly I'd like you to read a passage, I think we've asked you to read from page 45 to 46, about the trees from their own perspective.
Indeed, thank you. Humans walk by us every day. They sit and sleep, smoke and picnic in our shade. They pluck our leaves and gorge themselves on our fruit. They break our branches, riding them like horses as children, or using them to birch others into submission when they become older and more cruel. They carve their lover's name on our trunks and vow eternal love. They weave necklaces out of our needles and paint our flowers into art. They split us into logs to heat their homes, and sometimes they chop us down just because we obstruct their view.
And it goes on, obviously, but it is remarkable. And there's a lot of literature, certainly under COVID, about trees, about the natural world. Suddenly the world began to, really value the power of botany, the power of the outdoors, certainly during COVID. I know that this was written not particularly at that time, but when did that strike you?
I really think we are at a crossroads, both with the pandemic, but of course, climate crisis. As we're speaking, our planet, our only home is burning, and we have no time to lose. There are wildfires going on in Turkey as we're speaking. And today, a video was released with the sounds, the screams almost of animals dying in wildfires. We tend to forget that we're not the owners of this planet. We're not, above all other creatures. I think we have to reconnect with our earth, our nature, and understand, and we need a bit more humility, and we have no time to lose. So I believe we're at a major crossroads as the climate and ecological crisis is definitely accelerating.
And again, you do write so much about, issues that face us today through all the vehicles and metaphors that you particularly employ to such effect. But I want to ask you about your own life, because a little bit of Ada's story and Defne and Kostas is a little bit a metaphor for your own life. You and your parents left Turkey, came to London, and you said in one interview about writing, "I started writing fiction when I was very young, not because I wanted to be an author, but because I thought life was really boring. I needed books in order to stay sane. To me, Storyland was much more colorful and enticing than the real world. The desire to be a writer came only in my 20s. I love that. Expand on that. Life was boring for you as a kid.
It was quite boring. I was an only child raised by a single mother, a working mother. And in a way, I was raised by two women, my mother and my grandmother. It was a matriarchal house, but in a very conservative, very patriarchal place, Turkey. And as you pointed out, I did live in different countries, cities, but there were movements, migrations. And I thought life was quite boring. Books really opened up a completely different world for me, gave me other possibilities. And for that, I will always be grateful to books. The desire to become an author came to me much later. But I guess what I'm trying to say is all these issues that I cover in the book, whether it's belonging, non-belonging, exile, roots being uprooted, rerooted, or rootless, some might say, these are issues that are very close to my heart. And so thinking about trees also helped me to connect with perhaps my own journeys in life.
And finally, language is really important, and what language you speak and communicate and work in. You are Turkish by birth, and you've written most of your books in that language, in Turkish, all the ones that have been read by Westerners. And I think your first English language book was in 2004, The Saint of Incipient Insanities. You've said, "I still find it easier to express melancholy and longing in Turkish, but humor is definitely easier in English. We don't have a word for irony in Turkish."
It's true. I mean, for me, it was a challenge, to be honest, to start writing in English, because obviously, I have not been raised in a bilingual household, and English for me is an acquired language. I am an immigrant in this language. And like many immigrants, I'm very much aware of this gap between the mind and the tongue. The mind always runs faster, and the tongue is trying to catch up. And that gap can be quite intimidating, in fact. But I think what I've noticed over the years is I love the sense of freedom that comes to me when I speak or think in English, write in English. To be a writer in Turkey is quite heavy. To be a woman writer or a woman novelist in Turkey is even heavier. And I think I needed a little bit of cognitive distance. It's like taking a step back. And maybe it even helped me to take a closer look at the country and the culture where I was coming from. So my connection with each language is very different. With the Turkish language, it's more emotional. My connection with the English language is more cerebral. But as you pointed out, when it comes to melancholy or sorrow, those things are always easier to express in Turkish. But I love humor. I love compassionate humor. I love satire, irony. Those are much easier in English.
Can you, in our last 45 seconds, tell us what you're working on next? What is your next story, or is that a closely guarded secret?
When I finish a novel, I don't immediately start another one. There's a pendulum for me. You know, I become a more normal or social human being when the novel is over. Because I'm an introvert by nature, I read. I only read and listen. I think as writers, we need to be good readers and good listeners and see what the universe is telling me and what kind of story it's going to bring me. So at the moment, I'm just reading.
Well, that's a good place to be, Elif. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, our next guest is the anti-racist educator Robin DiAngelo, famed for her best-selling book, White Fragility. DiAngelo's work aims to educate white progressives on the part they play within a racist culture. It's a theme she continues in her newest book, Nice Racism. And here she is explaining her work and the criticism that's been leveled against her to Michelle Martin.
Thanks, Christiane. Robin DiAngelo, thank you so much for joining us once again.
I'm so happy to be with you, Michelle.
Your first book, White Fragility, it was published when, I think, June of
2018.
It spent more than a year on the bestseller lists. There was another resurgence of interest after last summer's social justice protest. Your latest book, Nice Racism. What does this book do, the second book do, that the first one did not? What was your goal with this one?
The first book set out to establish the existence of systemic racism. This book starts from that premise. It starts with the assumption that my readers are with me. I'm not having to prove the existence of systemic racism, and they want a deeper dive. There was a very provocative question, statement that I made in White Fragility that I get asked about a lot, and that is that white progressives may, in fact, cause the most daily harm across race. And this book set out to answer how we do that.
Why nice racism? What's nice racism?
Well, I hope that it grabs your attention because it seems like an oxymoron, but it's the kind of racism that is behind a smile or the assumption that the presence of niceness or a culture of niceness is an indication of the absence of racism. And I would argue that racism can and does flourish in a culture of niceness, because culture of niceness tends to be one that assumes the white experience as universal. It's a conflict avoidant culture where issues that cause discomfort are seen as some kind of breach in the social contract. It tends to be more passive aggressive and just harder to get your hands on. There's more gaslighting. It's the more subtle end of that continuum of racism.
One of the things that I found striking about the book is really at the very beginning, your argument is that actually you think kind of nice racism causes more daily harm to people of color than the sort of overt, aggressive kind. So tell me why you say that nice racism is actually, you think, on a day-to-day basis could be more pernicious.
Yeah, and insidious. Let me be clear, not to downplay the impact of really explicit racism and the impact of voter suppression and the legal blocking of us being able to just acknowledge the existence of racism. It's a very, very serious, very powerful and effective backlash. But it's easy to get your hands on. It's very clear. And it's also easy to avoid people who would stand behind those kinds of acts. So on a daily basis, and since we're being direct and blunt, Michelle, you're in a classic white progressive environment and institution. On a daily basis, you likely do not interact with white nationalists or people who would profess explicit racism. On a daily basis, you interact with me and people just like me. And the theme that I hear over and over, particularly from Black people who are in overwhelmingly white environments, is exhaustion. And not just exhaustion from the, you know, daily work, but the exhaustion from that culture of niceness that covers up and makes it harder to talk about the more subtle, I'm going to put air quotes, subtle to me, slights and indignities, the unexamined assumptions about your qualifications or how you got your job, or the resentment simmering just under the surface that I hear quite often from white people talking about diversity hires, or we had to, and that's why. You know, that creates a culture too that can be debilitating.
Give an example. I can give one, you can give one. I'll give one, being the what recently happened at ESPN, the sports network, where a white correspondent was overheard making comments about her disappointment that a Black colleague of hers had had a kind of a high profile position covering basketball. And she said, look, I totally get that they need to deal with their diversity problems, but not at my expense. And it's caused this huge internal uproar. The African-American correspondent wound up leaving the network after that. Obviously, I'm not privy to all the internal sort of, you know, discussions that went on. But is that an example of what you're talking about?
I think it's a great example because we have kind of a two-part move. The first move is I'm all for diversity, right? So this isn't somebody who's coming out and saying we shouldn't have diversity. And yet the but, which has much more weight, is you won't do it on my back, if you will. And so now you have white feminism, the kind of resentment that white women can feel because patriarchy's real. sexism and misogyny are real. And sometimes our resentment about that, our sense that we're not being seen or heard, can translate to us not being open to where we're not seeing or hearing somebody else. So she expressed that resentment that I'm talking about, that somehow you have to, rather than seeing it as an enhancement or a contribution.
Let's sort of stay with that as an example, if you don't mind. Why isn't she allowed to have her feelings too?
Well, I mean, of course, she's allowed to have her feelings, but it does translate into the climate. It's going to come out in some kind of way. If I am your coworker and I basically resent you and see you as kind of taking something that is inherently mine, you're going to feel that from me. It's going to impact the workplace. It's going to, I will probably undermine you in ways that I might not even be aware that I'm doing so. And I'm pretty sure, and you can check me if I'm wrong, that you can feel that from me, right? And that it impacts you as you do your job.
It's interesting because, you know, your books for some people, obviously they haven't been bestsellers for as long as they have for no reason, because obviously some people feel like, yeah, it just brings a sense of peace. It's comforting. It's like to realize, oh, I'm not crazy. I really am experiencing these things. But for some people, they just seem to find it infuriating. And I'm just curious about what you think is behind that fury.
Yeah, if you can't let go of that idea that it's a moral issue, it's a matter of good people versus bad people, you're going to be infuriated by it. You're going to think that somebody is saying that you are an immoral person, and you're not going to understand that. It's going to feel like an unfair accusation. And I'm with you. I find it incredibly freeing and liberating. I don't find it at all a guilt enhancing. It just kind of like moves you past all of the defensiveness into a place of deep self-reflection. And so I think that's a piece of it for people who are hanging on to this idea of either or. Apparently, a lot of white people think that if you can talk to Black people calmly, you can't be racist. You know, this idea that proximity is proof. And this is another way that I think nice racism manifests, is the urgency that many of us feel who are white to establish as quick as possible that we're not racist. And all of the ways we seek to establish that are pretty much not convincing. The evidence we offer up is kind of ridiculous.
Like what?
Like, I can't be racist. I marched in the 60s. I can't be racist. I had a Black roommate in college. I can't be racist. I work on a really diverse team. I've heard people say, I'm not racist. I'm from Boston. I speak several languages. I mean, it does beg the question, what do you think racism is that this would, you know, ensure that you're free of it? You know, Harvey Weinstein was around women all the time. He was married to a woman. Did that mean he couldn't have misogynistic orientation to the world? And that while he didn't assault all women, I imagine if I was around him, I would pick up on it.
You know, on the other hand, I have to say some of the more stinging critiques that I've seen have come from people of color, is that in trying to point the finger at white people, that you dehumanize and flatten out Black people in particular, or people of color, that people of color become sort of the moral authority. They are the ones who are the wise ones. They are the ones who are the ones who sort of gift everyone with their moral sensibility. And that's kind of racist in its own way. What do you say to that?
Well,
I mean, Black people can be jerks too, right? Black
absolutely.
People can be pompous, self-absorbed, narrow-minded, bigoted jerks too.
There have always been Black people who will claim that racism doesn't exist and they rarely ever experienced it, that, you know, the problems that Black people have are brought upon themselves and they will be embraced and their voices will be amplified. And so I don't take that as seriously as I take somebody who has a record and a commitment to anti-racism critiquing me. So let's move to those folks. And absolutely, it's the master's tools dilemma. And I'm actually at a place where I'm wondering why anyone thinks any one person could get this right and get this right by everybody and is responsible to get it absolutely right by everyone. Of course, there are going to be critiques. And yes, in a way, I do see that. I'm asking white people to basically defer. And that's because most of the white people, my audience, have not or could not answer the question, what does it mean to be white? And if you're at that place where you've never even thought deeply, I don't think you're in a position to determine what is legitimate and what is not legitimate. You know, what is valid to what you're sharing about your experience and what isn't. And, you know, does it hurt to defer? Does it hurt to just listen openly and consider the possibility that what this person is sharing with you?
You're not the first white person to write about racism from a white perspective and to direct your writings to other white people. I'm thinking about a number of people. I'm just wondering why you think people come at you so hard. And I wonder if you think gender is part of it, or why do you think people have come at you so hard?
I do think gender is part of it. I expect my ideas as an academic and my theories and my analysis to be engaged with and questioned, mm-hmm. but it's the personal. There's been a lot of personal vilification that is not typical when somebody writes a book and, you know, makes a provocative mm-hmm. argument. And, mm-hmm. and I think gender is a piece of that. And I do want to say that over the past 5 years, there have been 32 books about race on the New York Times bestseller list. And 29 of them have been written by Black people, and only 3 by people who were not Black, and one of them is me. A couple of those books have been on longer than my book. So it's simply not true that people aren't listening to Black people on this topic. You know, I'm speaking to the majority of folks who perpetuate this problem.
Talk to me, if you would, about critical race theory. As you and I are speaking now, there's been this tremendous effort to, by some states, to outlaw the teaching of issues around race and class, but mostly race, in in school districts around the country. I don't want to give a number because that may be wrong by the time people hear this conversation, but I think at least a dozen states now are moving to either outlaw the teaching of critical race theory or to regulate how teachers can talk about kind of race and class in school settings, to take certain books off the shelves, for example, in school libraries. What do you think that's about?
And let me just say, it's stunning and terrifying. And I think it really speaks to where power lies, that quickly actual laws could be on the books. Summer of 2020 was really different. It'd been a long time since you saw that kind of galvanization from white people, and the backlash has been swift and powerful. We have always manipulated the white populace through animus and anti-blackness. You know, the Southern strategy is tried and true, and critical race theory is the perfect new boogeyman. Right. It's just vague enough to, you know, sound scary. And because really it just means critically thinking about the origins of such persistent racial inequality. I'm not a critical race theorist in that it truly comes out of legal scholarship. But I am, according to this kind of boogeyman approach, in that what they're really talking about is anyone who says that systemic racism exists, anyone who says that our country was built on it and it's in the foundation, that is someone who's going to be labeled a critical race theorist.
One of the bills, for example, moving through the Texas legislature says that students shouldn't have to talk about something if it makes them uncomfortable. What's your best argument to white people about why they should make themselves uncomfortable?
Well, I would ask two questions. One, who does it serve, or what does it serve not to have this conversation? It's not neutral or benign. Who's made uncomfortable by this conversation, right? And I would ask, is there any other social ill that we would argue the best approach to that social ill is to never speak of it? Suicide, bullying, eating disorders, sexual assault? Would we argue that we should never speak about those things? I don't think we would. So there is something different here. And I think it's about deeply vested interests. I do think that white middle and upper class parents who believe that their children should have the best of everything are in large part leading some of this backlash against looking at racial inequality in schools, right? Anything that would cause their children not to have access to the best will be perceived as a threat, or to cause their children to feel uncomfortable. But research just really shows that actually young people do so much better when they're equipped to engage in conversations like this, when they have information, when they're prepared to understand the world in a way that makes sense to them and that they can actually act in the world.
How do you want this book to be used, if I could put it that way?
Well, we did build into it reflection questions. So as a guide to keep trying, keep struggling, to stay engaged, to find some kind of inspiration and some sense of guidance. Right? Because this is hard. This is hard. Let me just be really clear. Two key things. As a white person, I live, love, work, create every single day in a racist culture in which I'm comfortable. I am comfortable in a racist culture. I'd like to change that, right? If that discomfort helps bring some of that racism down, then it's actually a good thing. And as a white person, I was never meant to know or love Black people. You know, let's be honest, white people in large part measure the value and the status of their environments, their schools, their neighborhoods, by the absence of any significant number of Black people. That's pretty deep, right? And we're not gonna challenge that and build those relationships and see humanity in one another if we continue to live in segregation.
Robert Angelo, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The challenging and difficult conversations that we must keep having. And finally tonight, Biles is back, flipping and rotating her way to an Olympic bronze medal on the balance beam after withdrawing from team gymnastic events over mental health and spatial awareness concerns. The great American champion came back to perform a modified routine without any of the twisties that caused her to lose her bearings while in the air. Gold and silver went to China, but Biles said she was thrilled to have actually been able to compete and mount the medal podium.
So I had to be medically evaluated every day, and then I had two sessions with a sports psychologist from Team USA. But I've been training Beam every day. We just last minute decided to switch the dismount, which I probably have not done since I was like 12 years old, because I've always twisted off and done a full in since I was probably 13 or 14. Just to have one more opportunity to compete at the Olympics meant the world to me.
Given all that happened to her in Tokyo, she calls this medal even more special than the bronze she won in the same event at the Rio 2016 Games. I will cherish it for a long time, she said. And they're also already suggesting that she'll be back for the Paris Olympics. That's it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.